Church, would you stand with me as we read our text for this morning? Once again, it's from the Song of Songs, chapter 3, beginning in verse 1. On my bed by night, I sought him whom my soul loves. I sought him but found him not. I will rise now and go about the city, in the streets and in the squares. I will seek him whom my soul loves. I sought him, but found him not. The watchmen found me as they went about in the city. Have you seen him whom my soul loves? Scarcely had I passed them when I found him whom my soul loves. I held him and would not let him go until I had brought him into my mother's house and into the chamber of her who conceived me. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or the does of the field, that you not stir up or awaken love until it pleases. What is that coming up from the wilderness like columns of smoke, perfumed with myrrh and frankincense, with all the fragrant powders of a merchant? Behold, it is the litter of Solomon. Around it are 60 men, some of the mighty men of Israel, all of them wearing swords, an expert in war, each with his sword at his thigh against the terror by night. King Solomon made himself a carriage from the wood of Lebanon. He made its posts of silver, its back of gold, its seat of purple. Its interior was inlaid with love by the daughters of Jerusalem. Go out, O daughters of Zion, and look upon King Solomon, with the crown with which his mother crowned him on the day of his wedding, on the day of the gladness of his heart. This is the word of the Lord. Church, you can be seated. Thank you. Well, earlier this year, me and Aaron and the kids all went on a beach vacation with my side of the family. Admittedly, we were all very excited to visit the ocean. For most of our kids, it was the first time they had ever seen the ocean in person. So we were all really thrilled about the prospect of seeing the ocean together. But we quickly found out that this wasn't going to be what we hoped it would be. Due to the time of year that we were there, the riptide in the ocean was incredibly strong, which meant that we had to keep all the kids out of the water basically most of the time because the water was dangerous. And so our first day there, we were all down at the beach. All the kids were like kind of relegated to playing in the sand. They weren't able to get in the water. And our youngest niece, Lottie, really wanted to swim. She kept asking, can we go to the pool? If we can't swim in the ocean, will you take us to the pool? And her parents kept telling her, Lottie, we'll go in a little bit. Just have to wait. Hold your horses. Be patient. Really, it wasn't just Lottie that was doing it. It was pretty much all the kids. And so eventually they wore us down. We packed up all of the stuff that we had brought down there with us to set up. We packed it all up. We made our way to the pool. As we were walking there, my sister-in-law suddenly looks around and goes, where's Lottie? Has anybody seen where she went? None of us knew. She had basically disappeared. She had vanished into thin air. If you've ever parented a little kid, you know how quickly this can happen. And you know that feeling of panic that comes over you when it does happen. To be honest with you, my first thought was, did that little girl try to get in the rip current? Did she try to get in the water and just get carried away in like 2 seconds? So we were like all running all over the beach, scouring it, looking everywhere we could think to look. We were all shouting her name. Strangers were coming to help us. We had lifeguards looking for her. And as this was all going on, in my mind, I was praying, Lord, please let this not be like our worst nightmare. Of course, Lottie was okay. She had just gone up to the pool by herself because she had gotten tired of waiting. She didn't want to wait anymore. This little girl is like a firecracker. I look at her and I think, are you going to change the world? Maybe you are. She's a go-getter. But to be honest, when we learned that she was safe, I had this crazy moment that is so out of character for me. I'm not a big crier. If you know me well, you know that. But I had this moment where, like, I just collapsed on the beach and wept. I was so relieved that nothing had happened to this little girl. To be honest with you, the experience of that was like waking up from a horrible dream and finding out everything was going to be okay. In our text for today, there's kind of a similar dynamic at work. At the start of chapter 3, we find the bride of Solomon in a dreamlike state. Just pay attention to what she says in verse 1. She tells us, "On my bed by night, I sought him whom my soul loves. I sought him, but I found him not." For her, this sounds like a bad dream. She longs for her beloved. There's no one that she wants more than him. When he's not there, when he's not with her, her heart aches for him. And yet in this dream, he is nowhere to be found. She is searching and searching and looking and looking and running through the streets and calling out his name. And she keeps coming up empty. It's like Solomon has vanished. So here she is tossing and turning in her bed. She's having this panic dream that suddenly Solomon has changed his mind about her. It's as if her worst fears are coming true. Remember, earlier she had doubted that Solomon could really love her for who she is. That's how the book starts out in chapter 1. She's wondering, could Solomon really love me? Could he really want me? I'm so ordinary. Could he truly desire me? Turns out he could. Solomon really does love her. So what does she do? She lets her guard down, right? She lets her heart be carried away with love and desire for this man. But here she's dreaming that she is suddenly deprived of him, and there is nothing she can do about that. And I think for us, it's easy to relate to that, isn't it? It's not hard to identify with what this woman is feeling here, because we've all had a similar experience just like this. We've all had those moments in our lives where we desired something, right? Where we longed for something with all of our hearts, but we find that suddenly we can't have what we wanted. It slipped through our fingers. It slipped through our grasp, which signals to us something that deserves to be recognized this morning. This is a reality that we would do well to acknowledge. It's this: human desire is one of the most impactful things in the universe. Human desire is one of the most impactful things in the universe. Speaking just strictly from like an earthly perspective, the longings that exist in every human heart are a potent force. So much of what's happening in the world around us is like the outworking of human desire. It's all the fruit of human desire, from the wailing of a small child in a grocery store to the launching of a nuclear missile. We, human beings, are creatures of desire. That's how we were made. We are designed to search for that which will satisfy our longing hearts. So here's where I want to go with that today. As we look at chapter 3 of the Song of Songs, here's what I want you to walk away with. Jesus offers himself to satisfy your deepest desires. Jesus offers himself to you. Like, I think in this passage, the Lord is extending to us a profound invitation. It's the same invitation that we find in the prophecy of Jeremiah. In chapter 29, the Lord tells his people in Babylonian exile, "You will seek me and find me when you seek me with all your heart." Now just hold that verse in mind as we look back at our text. Notice with me how often the language of seeking and finding appears in this text. Read the first few verses with me, starting in verse 1. "On my bed by night," look, she says, "I sought him. I sought him whom my soul loves. I sought him, but found him not. I will rise now. I will go about the city, in the streets, in the squares. I will seek him whom my soul loves. I sought him, but found him not. But the watchmen of the city found me." They were going about the city, and so I asked them, "Have you seen the one that my soul loves?" Scarcely had I passed them when I found him whom my soul loves. So you can see that this part of the Song of Songs begins with seeking and culminates with finding. Again, this woman is in a dreamlike state. She is deprived of her beloved, and so she throws caution to the wind. She doesn't care about anything else or anyone else except finding the one she loves. That's actually another phrase that is used multiple times in our text. Several times she speaks of him whom my soul loves. I think the repetition of words in this text is really important because it can remind us that loving and seeking are always connected. Loving and seeking are always connected. The two cannot be torn asunder. You will pursue that which you love and desire. So here's where I want to take this morning. The sermon for today only has two points. I'm going to keep it simple. But think of these as two realities that lie behind your deepest desires. Underneath everything you do and say and think and feel, these two realities are almost certainly operational. And they are deeply, deeply spiritual. Here's the first reality. You have a seeking heart because you were made to be satisfied. You have a seeking heart because you were made to be satisfied. Now, I've been a Christian for about two decades now, which means that for the past 20 years or so, I've spent a lot of time thinking about and praying about my own desires. And in that time, I've always been at least a little bit troubled by something. I find it troubling that there is always something I want. There's always something I want. You guys know what I'm saying, right? Like I have never once woken up in the morning and thought to myself, I don't want anything today. All my desires suddenly vanished. I've magically become stoic. Never once have I been able to say that. There's always been this desire, some kind of ache that is pulling my heart in a certain direction. And there are times where that bothers me. That bothers me because, to be quite honest, I think life would be a lot easier if I could just stop wanting things. My life would be way easier if I could just figure out how to get rid of that impulse to seek. If I could train my heart to not be a seeking heart, I would be a lot happier. I would be less irritable, less agitated. I would have more peace. I would have more rest. But I've learned that I can't stop desiring. It's just something I can't do, nor should I. I think there are a number of religions we could name this morning. There's a number of schools of like philosophy we could name this morning that are entirely built around this idea that you can get rid of desire, that you can stifle or suppress desire. You can empty yourself of that. But I actually don't think that's what the Lord wants from us. I don't think that's the biblical vision of what to do with your desire. Remember, the Lord created us with a seeking heart. That's why we have all these desires in the first place. And if that's true, if it's true that we have these seeking hearts, we have these desires, then there must be something somewhere, some reality that is right-sized for what's going on inside of us. C.S. Lewis once put this really insightfully. He wisely said, "If I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world." One of the most tragic things that you'll ever see is when a person recognizes the first part of that statement but fails to grasp the second part of that statement. I can remember some years ago coming across an interview with Tom Brady. It was like a 60 Minutes interview, something like that, on TV. The interviewer said, "Tom, you've won all these Super Bowls, you've had all this success, you've won these championships. Which one of them means the most to you? Which one of them stands out to you?" And Tom looks at the interviewer and he says, "The Super Bowl that means the most to me is the next one, the one that I haven't gotten yet." He says, "Every time I think one is going to satisfy me or fulfill me, I always end up coming up empty. It doesn't do the trick. I keep searching and searching and seeking and seeking. And you hear Tom Brady say that, and it's like, Tom, keep pulling on that thread. Right? If you keep pulling on that, if you keep following that train of thought, you're going to end up not far from the kingdom. To my knowledge, Tom has not done that, but that shouldn't surprise any of us. That's how we, as fallen human beings, so often are. We try to satisfy an otherworldly desire with a this-worldly pursuit. We're like the woman in this passage, searching for King Solomon, but then we end up settling for George Costanza. We all have our ways of doing that, though, don't we? We all have our own version of this. Tom Brady, at one point in his life, it was Super Bowls. But I'm curious, what about you? What is your version of this? What's been that thing in your life lately that has made you think to yourself, if I just had this, I would finally be satisfied. I'd finally be fulfilled. I'd finally be happy. How would you fill in that blank for yourself? I actually think this is a really important question for us because we're such a young church. Many of us here in the room are under the age of 40, which means if I had to guess, there is a lot of angst in this room right now over unfulfilled desires. Maybe you're young, you're trying to get your life off the ground. You've been searching for that thing, that next thing that's going to get you to where you want to go, to where you want to be, but that thing has eluded you time and time again. It has slipped through your hands. Maybe it's the right job. Maybe it's the right paycheck, the right spouse, the right family situation, but for whatever reason, that's not happening for you. It hasn't worked out the way you thought. And it has left you disillusion. Maybe even a little bit resentful. There's like this sense of quiet, seething, shameful frustration that has settled over your life. In my experience, it's not uncommon for people to feel that way in their 20s, 30s, and 40s, where you're well into your adult years, but you're also wondering, man, is this all I'm going to be? Is this all I'm ever going to amount to? Like here, I was seeking to be so much more than this. I was seeking to make my mark on the world, to have the good life, to carve out my own place on this earth. And for all my seeking, for all my pursuits of the life I thought I should have, I have come up short. This happens to people way more often than you think. There are so many people who are approaching middle age or in middle age or around middle age who are going through life with like this huge sense of despondency. I mean, if I could be vulnerable with you for a second, at this stage of my life, I've experienced some of this myself. There have been moments where in the depths of my own soul, I can't shake this sense of grief that I thought I would be further along by now. But the reality is I'm just not. And when we find ourselves in that place, when you're in that place of disillusionment, it can be tempting to come across a passage like this and think to yourself that the moral of the story is that the woman gets everything she wants. Right? In verse 4, she finds what she's searching for. All her dreams have come true. She lives happily ever after. So maybe at some point in the near future, the same thing will happen for me. Maybe I'll get that. Or maybe not. Maybe I've missed the boat. Maybe it's too late. The dream is dead. It'll never happen for me. So I'll just settle into my resentment. I'll spend the rest of my life kind of shaking my fist at God. I'll settle for my bitterness. But I actually don't think that's the takeaway of this passage. I don't think that's what the text is telling us. It's not telling us that dreams come true for some people and they pass other people by. The point of the text is that at the end of all your seeking, at the end of all your longing and your disappointment, at the end of it all, there is someone who loves you more than you could ever fathom. He loves you. And his love is actually the thing that you've really been seeking all along. It's been right there in front of you the whole time, Sunday after Sunday, in the preaching of a gospel that tells you that God shows his love for us. And that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. When his amazing love finds you, when it lands on you in the middle of your disappointment, you learn that Jesus is all you've ever really had. And so you find yourself clinging to him for dear life. Just like in verse 4. This woman gives us a picture of that, doesn't she? She couldn't find her beloved. She went through the city looking for him. She came across the watchman of the city. She says, "Have you guys seen him? Do you know where my beloved is?" And as those words are leaving her mouth, as her desperation is at its peak, her beloved finally appears. Solomon emerges from the shadows of the night, and at the end of all her searching, she finds herself clinging to the one who loves her most. She says, "I held on to him, would not let him go." This is a picture of what the Lord is inviting us to do when we find ourselves disillusioned by life. He says, "Come to me, all who are weary. Come to me, all who are heavy and heavy laden. Come to me, those who are burnt out and exhausted by life. Come to me, find me, run into my presence, cling to me for dear life." And Jesus' promise is, "I will love you in the exact way that you need to be loved." We see this at the end of John's gospel, where Jesus is raised from the dead and Mary Magdalene encounters him that very morning. At first, she thought it was the gardener, but when Jesus called her name, she realized it was her rabbi. It was the one she had walked with. She recognized the voice of her good shepherd and she clung to him. John tells us she clung to him. With all her heart. So from the scriptures this morning, let me encourage you with this. You will never be sorry that you clung to Jesus. You will never be sorry that you held fast to him. In certain seasons of your life, it's going to be true. You're going to come up short. You're going to be disappointed. It may be that things don't pan out like you had hoped, but for those who seek the Lord, for those who hold on to Jesus when everything else is being painfully stripped away, for those who do that, in the end, they will never be put to shame. The psalmist tells us in Psalm 34, they will shine with the radiance of Christ. There's also another way of looking at these verses, though. Notice with me what the woman says in verse 4. In no uncertain terms, she talks about consummating her romance with Solomon. In her dream, she describes how she wants to take her beloved into an inner chamber behind a closed door. She calls it her mother's house. She describes it as the place she was conceived. I don't know about you guys, but there's nothing romantic about your parents' bedroom. A little bit weird. But in an ancient culture, this would have been a normal thing for a person to do. Maybe later on, you can go look at Genesis 24. It describes how Isaac gets married to Rebekah, and he brings his bride into the tent of Sarah, his mother. So essentially what's being said in our text is that this woman cannot wait to be married to Solomon. Even in her dream, she wants it so bad that she's not going to let him out of her sight until the knot is tied. That's how strong her desire is for Solomon. And yet, we come to find verse 5 takes a surprising turn. Just notice what she says next. She repeats something she'd said earlier in the psalm. You're going to recognize this. She says, "I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or the does of the field, that you do not stir up or awaken love till it pleases." That we found that also back in chapter 2, verse 7. So despite whatever longing is taking place in her dreams, this woman recognizes dreams are not real life. And so she tells the daughters of Jerusalem that despite her intense sexual desire for Solomon, she recognizes the time for that has not yet come. She must first be married to him. So let me take this chance to be a faithful pastor and remind those in the room who are unmarried or those in the room who are young that if you desire marriage one day, you desire to be married, that is a good desire. If that's your desire, it's a good one. It is of God. But at the same time, God's wisdom does not do shortcuts. Here's what I mean by that. Do not give yourself sexually to a person who has not first committed to you in marriage. You should not have to sleep with someone in order to get them to commit to you. That is not love. That is someone using you. That is someone exploiting you. Because love puts commitment before intimacy. It guards your vulnerability with the promise that says, till death do us part. And I think this is something that really needs to be said in our day and time, because as Christians, we don't see this the same way the world does. The world gives itself over to casual sex, promiscuity. The world gives itself over to things like cohabitation. We as Christians, we don't do that. The scriptures warn us away from doing those things, from giving ourselves to those things. Of course, as Christians, we believe that sex is a very good gift from God. But one thing that must mean is that sex is not this sort of cheap, throwaway thing that our culture says it is. No, your sexuality matters to God because your body and soul matter to God. What you do with the body that He gave you is deeply important to His heart. That's why verse 5 is so well timed in this passage, because it's keeping us from getting swept away in the emotions, in the desires. It's keeping us tethered to reality. It is reminding us of God's wisdom for a fallen world. The woman tells us, I desire to be with Solomon in the most intimate way possible, but it's not time for that yet. And still, she knows that when that time does come, it will have been worth the wait, because here is a man who has committed to her. That's really what comes through and what happens next. This woman is about to find out that while she was seeking her beloved, while she was anxious to find him, it was actually her beloved who was seeking her all along. As she's dreaming about him in her bed, he was actually wide awake, thinking of all the ways that he could best love her. Think about it. Here's this couple. Here's this man and this woman, and they are far more interested in each other than they are in themselves. There's not an ounce of self-absorption between these two people. You guys, what a profound lesson this is for our relationships, especially and particularly our marriages. I am convinced that most problems between married people would dramatically decrease if we would just put into practice what we're seeing here in our text for this morning. You know, another place we see it is Philippians chapter 2, what Paul says to us there. There he tells us, do nothing from selfish ambition or conceit, but in humility, count the other person more significant than yourself. Let each of you look not only to his own interests, but also to the interest of the other. So husbands and wives, do you regard the interests of your spouse as being more significant than your own? Are you more concerned for their well-being than you are in your own self-fulfillment? And listen, even as I ask that, I'm well aware that we are all sinners, present company included. This is not something that sinful human beings naturally want to do. But listen, if you keep on reading in Philippians 2, Paul tells us why this can actually be a reality in every single Christian marriage. Paul tells us it's because we have this mind in Christ Jesus. The reality is Christ has given us a new heart. Christ has given us a new transformed life. He's given us a new way of looking at other people, because in the gospel we see how he looks at us. We see how he thinks of us. We see his deep regard for sinners. We see him taking our interests to heart, even though we could not deserve it any less. That is why he died and was buried and rose again. It's because he wants what is best for you and me. He wants us to be reconciled to the Father. He wants us to be indwelled by the Holy Spirit. He wants us to be redeemed through his precious blood. And so for our sake, he became sin for us. He became obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. As you consider that, as you think of how Jesus has loved you so well, so faithfully, would you now take a look at your relationships? If you're married, take a look at your spouse and ask yourself, am I regarding my husband or my wife with the mind of Christ? Or is there something else, something other than the gospel that is defining our relationship? Like I said, Solomon exemplifies this in a very real way because while the woman was sleeping, he was actually off making preparations for their wedding. He was getting everything ready so that he could come and take her away to become his wife. The wedding festivities will now commence. And we get this glimpse of this because starting in verse 6, the passage begins to take a turn. The woman goes from waiting to find her beloved to her beloved coming up from the wilderness to find her. And he's coming to her with all kinds of fanfare, with much pomp and circumstance so that he can sweep her off her feet, so that he can take her breath away. But here's the second reality that stands behind your desires. You have a king who appeared to satisfy your seeking heart. The woman wakes up from her dream, and her beloved really is there. And not only is he there, he is making it abundantly clear to her that she means everything to him. Just look back at the lengths he's gone to show his affection for her. Remember, she has just woken up from this dream, right? She's still in her PJs. Her hair is still frazzled from a night of tossing and turning. It's a little bit tangled up. She has those eye crusties that you have in the morning. She's got morning breath. For crying out loud, this woman has not even had her first cup of coffee. And here comes Solomon to roll out the red carpet for her. Look at what he does. This is the man of her dreams, but in real life, he's even better than she thought. In fact, Solomon is so glorious and so grand in this moment that the writer of the song cannot help but describe him with imagery borrowed from the book of Exodus. Just notice verse 6. Notice how Solomon is described as coming up out of the wilderness. He is described as a column of smoke in the desert. You guys remember how the Lord led his people out of Egypt? He led them with a pillar of fire and of smoke. Or remember when he met them at Sinai, right? Scripture tells us that a cloud of smoke was wrapped around the mountain. Look also at how the writer describes these perfumes. Look at what he says there. Solomon is perfumed with myrrh and frankincense. Just recall in the book of Exodus how myrrh was used in the anointing oil of the tabernacle. It was used to anoint the Ark of the Covenant. Frankincense was also burned in the tabernacle as a pleasing aroma. Notice also that Solomon is being accompanied by mighty warriors. Right? David had his mighty men, but Solomon has twice as many. And they are all surrounding him as he's being carried in what could only be described as a covered portable couch. Solomon is resting on this enclosure. It's being carried by poles. What does that make you think of? What does that bring to your mind? For me, I don't know about you, but it makes me think of the Ark of the Covenant. So it's almost like this archetype figure is present in this procession, at the middle of this procession. It's like the author of this book is saying this wedding procession is so glorious that the only thing I could possibly compare it to is the story of God rescuing his people from the house of slavery. Nothing else will work. Nothing else will do. And as I've thought about that, I've thought, oh, that's kind of strange. It's a little bit of a stretch, I think, to describe a man, Solomon, in some of the same terms that you would speak of the God of Israel. It's enough to like start making me feel a little bit uncomfortable. That isn't unless this book, the Song of Songs, is about the Lord Jesus Christ. Of course, we all know the story of Solomon. If I could rewind the videotape a little bit, God promised that a son of David would reign on the throne of Israel forever. And you got to think that Solomon heard that promise and he thought, I'm going to be that guy. I'm going to be that son. And for a while, Solomon was very impressive. He was spectacular. He was wealthy and wise beyond any of his peers. For a while, there were probably a lot of people looking at Solomon, thinking to themselves, he may be the son. He may be the one that was promised. You know, over time, it became clear Solomon is not the one they were looking for. Solomon ended up falling. He ended up failing pretty dang hard. He failed so hard, in fact, that the kingdom of Israel was torn in part. It was torn in two. Like, how would you like to have that as your legacy? Think about having that happen on your watch. You're supposed to be the guy, the royal son who would reign forever, and you can't even keep the country intact. Solomon was told, you might be the Messiah, but eventually he realizes, I'm just a mess. You can take the I-A-H off the word, and that's me. That's who I am. So there's this real sense in which Solomon can't even come close to living up to this portrayal of him in the song. It must be about something else. It must be about someone greater. The king in this passage is godlike. I mean, he's human, of course, we understand that, but he's presented in ways that could only be described as divine. He is the promised son of David, but he also resembles the Lord, merciful and gracious, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness. Who else could that be except King Jesus? Well, what Solomon could only aspire to, what Solomon could only fall woefully short of, Jesus Christ really is. He is the one who led a people out of Egypt with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. He is the one who led his people faithfully and safely through the sea. He split the waters in half, and they became like a bride walking down the aisle to be presented to their bridegroom. Which that's what happened at Mount Sinai. Jesus was the one who met them there, and he told them, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery, and I want you to love me and desire me and worship me alone. Do not give your heart to another. That's Jesus' word to his people. That's why he redeemed his people. That's why he delivered them. And it's why he still is. Through his life and his death, in his resurrection, he has revealed his great salvation to us. And he did that because he wants us. He loves us. And he wants to satisfy our seeking hearts. Remember, that's why you have the desires you have. Your desires are not some problem that you need to get rid of. They just need to be directed toward their true and proper end. I know you've been searching. I know you've been looking for that thing, that silver bullet that's going to fulfill you. Isn't it time that you finally found what you're looking for? Solomon's father, King David, gives us an example to follow. We read it as our call to worship this morning. But I just want to read it to you again. Look at this with fresh eyes. Listen to it with an open heart. In this psalm, David is in a Judean wilderness. He's fighting for his life. He reaches the end of himself. And it's there that he finds the love of God in a way that you only do when you realize that Jesus is all you have. Listen again to what David says. He says, oh God, you are my God. Earnestly I seek you. My soul thirsts for you. My flesh faints for you as in a dry and weary land. For there is no water. So I have looked upon you in the sanctuary, beholding your power and glory, because your steadfast love is better than life. My lips will praise you. I will bless you as long as I live. In your name I will lift up my hands. My soul will be satisfied as with fat and rich food, and my mouth will praise you with joyful lips when I remember you upon my bed and meditate on you in the watches of the night. For you have been my help, and in the shadow of your wings I will sing for joy. My soul clings to you, and your right hand upholds me. Emmaus, I don't know about you, but when I hear that, I realize how crazy I have ever been to want anything more than I want Jesus. That's just so crazy. Like, here I am, like, asking him to make my life better. Here I am asking him to wave his magic wand over me and give me all these items on my wish list. Like, how blind could I be? How crazy am I? Like, I'm wanting these trinkets, and Jesus is offering me this. He's offering me something infinitely better. He's offering me himself. Because he knows that's what we were made for. We were made to be satisfied ultimately in him. Emmaus, would you?